How do you fight the emerald ash borer, an Asian beetle that's been destroying ash trees? How about enlisting a stingless wasp from its home country? Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The first batch of stingless wasps are being released today near Fairfield. We'll find out about the plan. Before that, analysis from last night's Democratic U.S. Senate candidate debate. Merger mania among the big boys in the ag industry. What's driving it? Also, what's behind Iowa's literacy gap among children? Pushing the positive in Mason City. And best-selling author and native Iowan Bill Bryson's words of wisdom to graduates. Buckle up for your Friday News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Lots to come this hour. Our News Buzz, of course, devoted to a handful of conversations about news that we didn't get to otherwise this week. A quick-moving hour, so stay tuned for these and other issues. How do you fight the emerald ash borer? That's that Asian beetle. It's been killing millions of ash trees. It's been pursuing ash trees through Iowa in about 31 counties now. Well, we'll hear about how the authorities are enlisting a stingless wasp from Asia as well to fight that emerald ash borer. Also, what's behind Iowa's literacy gap among children? A real treat for you at the end of the hour. Best-selling author and Iowa native Bill Bryson with a few words of wisdom that he gave to graduates at the University of Iowa a few days ago. But first, last night, Iowa's four Democratic candidates vying for the U.S. Senate, now occupied by, for a long time, he's occupied that position, Republican Charles Grassley. Since 1981, he's been our U.S. Senator. Now, the people who want to vie for that seat debated last night live on IPTV. Des Moines Register's political reporter Jason Noble was at the debate. He joins me now. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on with us. So we have Tom Feagan of Clarence, State Senator Rob Hogue, Cedar Rapids, Bob Krause of Fairfield, also former Lieutenant Governor Patty Judge. We've all heard, I've done interviews with all of them over the last few days here, but let's talk about this debate. How would you characterize the debate overall?
Well, you know, I think this was actually a pretty substantive and revealing debate. We saw definitely who each candidate feels like is their biggest rival within this primary race. And we saw that the candidates really go after each other in a way that tried to draw contrasts and reveal differences in record and background and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So give me a couple of examples. Who is going after whom about what issue?
Sure. Well, I think you saw each candidate sort of punching up and going after the person they thought was sort of ahead of them in the polls. And so you saw Tom Feagan going after Rob Hogue, Rob Hogue in turn going after Patty Judge, and Patty Judge in turn going after Chuck Grassley, who obviously wasn't there and isn't on the ballot this June, but is the guy they're all going to try to go against in November here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A moment that you remember about an issue, for instance, Rob Hogue, when he went after Patty Judge?
Sure. Patty Judge has had some issues with organized labor in this race, and a lot of that goes back to a 2008 bill on expanding collective bargaining rights. As lieutenant governor, Patty Judge was part of the conversation in the governor's office that led to a veto of that bill. Hogue went after her very strongly on that, said, you know, we don't want to have a rerun of 2010 in 2016, referring to when Culver and Judge lost their reelection bid. We haven't seen a lot of this so far from Rob Hogan. He's been talking even last night as he was kind of throwing these elbows that he wanted to run a positive campaign and not attack his opponents.
Mm-hmm. In my discussions with these four candidates, the environment played a big part. Did it play a part in last night's debate?
Absolutely. And this is where Hogue was kind of the man in the middle. On to one side of him, Tom Feagan was going after him on his environmental record, on inaction within the Iowa Senate, on like the Bakken oil pipeline and things like that. And Hogue, in turn, was raising this issue with Patty Judge and her role with this group that has opposed the Des Moines Waterworks lawsuit. This is definitely a candidate that's animating all of these. This is an issue that's animating all of these candidates, and something that I think is important to the voter base here in this primary race. Mm-hmm.
It's often said that Tom Feagan is channeling Bernie Sanders. Did you get that sense last night?
You know, we didn't hear a lot of the Bernie Sanders rhetoric in invoking his candidacy, but that's definitely a big part of Feagan's political identity. I like to point out even Tom Feagan's campaign logo has a Bernie Sanders logo embedded in it.
All right. So this relatively crowded field of candidates, four candidates, is thanks to the Supreme Court controversy, that filling or non-filling of the vacant ninth seat after the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. Did that come up at all in direct or indirect ways?
It did. And that was actually, I think, the leadoff question for Patty Judge, if she wasn't kind of questioning how serious she was and if she was the kind of the handpicked National Democratic Establishment candidate who were sensing an opportunity here with the death of Antonin Scalia and Chuck Grassley's central role in the nominating process that's played out or not really played out since then.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about the backgrounds of these candidates and how they differ.
Sure. Well, you've got Patty Judge, the former lieutenant governor and secretary of agriculture. She's been on the statewide ballot four times. She's won three times statewide. Theoretically, I think has a wider name recognition, is better known to Democrats than some of the other candidates. She did come into this race very late after the death of Scalia and when it became clear that Grassley was going to be a national focal point for this controversy over the Supreme Court nomination.
Right. Just to jump in there, one of the questions I asked her just the other day on this was, if Antonin Scalia had not died, would you be in this race? Her answer, I don't know. Right?
Right. And really central to her candidacy is the argument that Chuck Grassley has been there too long. She told me, I'm sure said in just about every event that she's done, that she wants to make this race not about her, not necessarily about the issues that she's really passionate about, but she wants to make it a referendum on Chuck Grassley.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little more about Bob Krause of Fairfield.
Bob Krause, he's a former state legislator. He served three terms in the House in the 1970s. He's been a transportation official with the Iowa DOT, and at the federal level, he's known as an advocate for veterans. He's also kind of a perennial candidate. You know, he ran, I think he ran for treasurer back in the 1970s. He ran for the U.S. Senate in 2010 and lost in the Democratic primary. He was in the race for governor in 2014 for a brief period of time. His name never actually showed up on the ballot. But he's kind of been a perennial candidate and at this point doesn't look like a real force within this race.
Mm-hmm. Did any of the four stand out as clear winners or slight winners, best communicators, best debaters? Were there standouts in that category?
I think clearly that Rob Hogue and Patty Judge had the strongest debate performances. In my story today in the Register, I quoted Diane Bystrom from Iowa State, a political scientist up there, and she saw Rob Hogue as the best communicator of the night. I think this was kind of a big step forward maybe for Hogue rhetorically. He did seem to be sort of in command of the issues and willing to take on his opponents in a way that we haven't seen before.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Jason, what's in store for these candidates between now and the June 7th primary?
Well, it's really down to crunch time. We've got about 10 days here. I know that Hogue is planning several events between now and then. I'm sure that Krause and Feagan are too. Patty Judge hasn't been quite as active out on the campaign trail, but she is on TV, which is a big difference in this race. She'll be airing TV ads in the major markets here in Iowa through Election Day, which Rob Hogue and the other candidates are not doing.
Okay. Jason Noble, political reporter for the Des Moines Register, telling us about a debate last night between the four-way race for the Democratic nomination to face Chuck Grassley in the general election. That June 7th Democratic primary coming up in just a few days. Jason Noble, thanks for the update.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, here's some ag news that you may have missed. Big news to miss. That's why we're pointing it out. Merger mania. Some of the largest proposed mergers the farm economy has ever seen. Some large-scale agriculture mergers are being considered, including the possible consolidation of these companies. Listen to this. Possible deals between the Germany-based Bayer and American seed giant Monsanto. Also between Switzerland-based Syngenta and ChemChina. That's a state-owned Chinese chemical company. And between American chemical companies Dow and DuPont, any of these mergers have the possibility of creating a real global leader in the ag industry. Joining me now to parse through the mergers, what they could mean for Iowa's ag industry, Chad Hart, extension economist and associate professor at Iowa State University. Hello, Chad.
How you doing?
Good. So tell us about some of the big dealings going on, being considered. Well, what's happening? Pick out a couple of the big ones there.
Well, as you look, they're all three big deals. And as you're looking here, it's a combination of, let's call it, you know, taking seed companies and combining with crop protection, crop chemical companies. As these companies are looking to, if you will, broaden their perspective in terms of reaching farmers because of a turn down, a slowdown in the agricultural economy.
Mm-hmm. So is that what's driving it, changes in the agriculture economy?
It definitely is. What we've seen over the past 3 years has been a substantial decline in crop prices that has dropped farm incomes here across the U.S., and that sort of, if you will, tightened the bottom line for farmers, made it a lot more competitive as far as selling farmers seed and other inputs, and that's why we're seeing this merger pressure build up on even the largest ag companies.
Mm-hmm. So what hurdles are standing in the way of these mergers, and how soon might they happen?
They could move fairly quickly. As I look at Dow DuPont, they're moving right along. The idea is made several announcements and already began to work with the federal government on how that merger would proceed. It will take some time, as you mentioned. You know, the biggest one would be Bayer Monsanto. That would take some time and would take some investigation as far as you're looking at a very large combined agricultural company there and what sort of requirements not only would the U.S. government put in front of that merger, but other countries would have some say in what as well as to how that merger would go about.
Mm-hmm. So investigation. So give us an idea of what they're investigating. Are these sort of antitrust questions primarily, how it would affect competition in the world in these products?
Definitely the case here. We'd be looking at antitrust competition cases here, not only looking in terms of, let's call it, price setting, but also in product development, especially as you're looking at the seed industry. You've basically listed off with Monsanto, Syngenta, and with DuPont, you know, the owner of Pioneer, the idea is you were looking at the three largest seed companies in the world, all three of them being involved in merger talks today.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the United States has every interest in seeing that the U.S. companies here come out in good stead, don't they? I mean, the USDA has some say in at least some of these proposed deals.
They would have some say, but more than likely this would be dealing with Departments of State, Department of Commerce, you know, looking at all sorts of issues here because a lot of these companies are not only agriculture, but they have some non-agricultural dealings as well. As you think about the Dow-DuPont merger, it was larger than agriculture. It had bigger impacts there, but ag was a major component mm-hmm. of that merger.
So if we look at Dow and DuPont, typically when large companies merge, they look at where they overlap, and then there are job losses, right?
There tend to be some job consolidation, but there also tends to be look for some synergies there. And what has been interesting about the mergers that have been listed here, it's a change from discussions about a year ago where we had, you know, there was some talk about Monsanto merging with Syngenta. So there you had two seed companies, two competitors, direct competitors talking about merger. Now we're talking about companies that tend to, if you will, be in parallel markets. Mm-hmm. When I look at Dow DuPont, you looked at DuPont as mainly the, let's call it, crop seed side of the market. Dow was more known for agricultural chemicals, so they weren't in as much direct competition, therefore not as much overlap.
Let's talk a little bit, but before we say goodbye, briefly about how this may change the ag industry, especially for those who consume the products of these companies, farmers, small and large, and perhaps us consumers. Will we even notice it?
For the consumer, we probably won't notice as much. For a farmer, there is concern that, again, as you look at consolidating these companies, will you see a slowdown in the development of some products? Because typically competition helps breed that product innovation. There's also, you know, some concern that, you know, are we getting too large companies where we could start to see some non-competitive price setting here. And so this is definitely an issue that I know the U.S. federal government is watching very closely. The Department of Justice is definitely looking this over for antitrust. But, you know, that's the deal. A producer would probably see more impact than farm consumers would.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And quickly, perhaps in summary, too, if these mergers go through, how will that landscape in big ag look 5-10 years down the road different?
Well, I would argue it's a natural evolution. We've seen this throughout agriculture. It used to be we had a lot of smaller seed companies. Now we've grown up in here the big three, and it looks like we'll maintain that big three status. But what we're talking about here is more, instead of just being known as a seed company, now you'll be known as an agricultural company. They're selling the seed, the chemicals, the fertilizer. We may even see some combination where we see some ag machinery companies merging with some seed companies or some fertilizer companies there. So we're broadening what an ag company means.
Okay, thanks very much for the explanation and the analysis. Chad Hart, Extension Economist, Associate Professor at Iowa State University, talking about some of the largest proposed mergers the farm economy has ever seen. So glad you could join us, Chad. Thanks.
Thank you very much, sir.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We had this in our news earlier this month. The City Council of Mason City voted to reject this $240 million hog processing plant. It's a plant that was expected to employ something like 2,000 workers in its first 2 years. Now, those against the plant cited environmental concerns. Those for it looked to those job opportunities. Some in the debate even claimed that the city did not want outside workers coming to town, citing racism as a reason for blocking the proposal. Now, this debate and subsequently the council's decision has divided Mason City residents and created some discord in the town, so much so that the local pastor, Pastor Chuck Kelsey, decided to take action. He organized a city meeting this week. It happened on Tuesday evening. It was meant to bring people together in the wake of this packing plant debate controversy. He joins me now, Father Chuck Kelsey, Pastor Chuck Kelsey, excuse me, at the First Congregational United Church of Christ. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ben.
So your congregation includes people on both sides of the debate that I just described, but I understand the point of your meeting was certainly not to rehash that debate.
Exactly. It was all about people coming together to help Mason City flourish, and irregardless of what any kind of business comes in or any kind of industry comes in, there needs to be a larger discussion of how to help Mason City be just an amazing place.
Mm-hmm. So what ground rules were set at this meeting? What did you sort of put as a framework?
Well, that we weren't going to again rehash what had happened at the council meetings. We weren't going to put anybody down in the process. It wasn't about the past. It was about where we're at in this moment, and to be able to share any ideas about helping Mason City continue some of the excellent things that have happened in the past, as far as development and things like the band festival that's happening this weekend, the 76th year of that, and just to be respectful of each other.
Mm-hmm. And there were people with other ideas. Share some of those.
Oh, yeah. A really awesome one, and I think addresses some of the misinformation that it was a racist piece that kept the company from coming in, was that a program called Welcoming City, and it's designed to help the community invite immigrants in to help possibly with some funding of restaurants or other small businesses that they might bring in, all that wonderful diversity. One of the ideas thrown out was let's talk to some of the businesses that are threatening to leave North Carolina because of discriminatory laws.
Mm-hmm.
Why not get them here? Mason City has got all this wonderful waterways. How can we better develop that and build on it? Mason City has the Iowa Traction Railroad. It's the only one of its kind around and runs electric railroad that runs from Clear Lake to Mason City, and how could that be further developed and further developed bike trails and farmers markets and music programs and even to invite artists in for weekends, some similar to the Iowa City Writers Workshop. What about an artist's workshop that could be supported here?
Now you in Mason City have been debating this hog processing plant and the debate around it. Both sides of it's been very controversial. The rest of us here in Iowa have followed it, or perhaps not followed it so closely. What has it done? What has been the impact of that debate on the community? Sort of a coarsening, perhaps, of relations in some cases?
No, I don't think that is the case. I think there are people who disagree, but in some, they're still willing to listen to each other. And I think the upside is this community's recognized that we're all trying to help Mason City flourish. The idea that communities around that are growing and attracting businesses are communities that really offer a variety of amenities that people crave, kind of the idea of a third place, a place that, like cafes and parks and things. And when those amenities are there, it draws in other business and people who want to live here, and it draws in a variety of ages and a variety of ethnicities. And I think this community really in the process is starting to understand that we're not that divided. That we really are all about helping Mason City be the wonderful place that one of the reasons we're here.
I understand you're struggling a bit, as many places are, with the issue of a brain drain among young people leaving town for lack of opportunity. How serious is that problem?
Well, I haven't done any research on it, but indeed there are people who graduate from high school and go to college and then decide to go elsewhere. We have two sons out in the California, San Francisco, and Oakland area ourselves. But I think Mason City is placed in such a wonderful spot between Minneapolis and Des Moines that we can offer that wonderful community and safety in community and diversity. It is quite a diverse area, actually, for Iowa. And yet, it's a simple 2 hours to go see some other things. And we have just tons of other things that are offered here anyway. We have NIAC, we have some community theater, we have Stebbins, we have bands, we have a ton of things that are being offered here already.
All right. Pastor Chuck Kelsey, thank you for joining us of the First Congressional United Church of Christ in Mason City, talking about organizing a meeting this week meant to bring people together in the wake of that packing plant debate that happened earlier this month, that culminated earlier this month when the City Council of Mason City voted to reject the $240 million hog processing plant. When we come back after a short break, how do you fight the emerald ash borer? That's this Asian beetle that's been destroying ash trees across the country. It's also here in Iowa. How about enlisting a stingless wasp from Asia as well? We'll find out about that. Also, what's behind Iowa's literacy gap among children, and the special treat at the end of the hour, best-selling author and native Iowan Bill Bryson with some words of wisdom. It's your Friday News Buzz. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a few minutes. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Since the discovery of this non-native pest from Asia, the emerald ash borer, also goes by the acronym EAB, has killed hundreds of millions of ash trees in North America. And it's also here in Iowa in over 30 counties. Sure, we have plenty of ash trees that these emerald ash borers are killing. But to help fight against the beetle, thousands of stingless wasps are now being introduced. They are natural enemies of the emerald ash borer, being released over the next few weeks. In fact, the first release happens today near Fairfield. Joining me to talk about this biocontrol project is Mike Kintner, emerald ash borer and gypsy moth outreach and regulatory coordinator with the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hello, thanks for having me today.
Explain the idea behind this release and this program.
The idea is we're looking for a way to naturally control Emerald Ash Borer. Obviously, it's a problem here in North America since it first landed in 2002, when we first found it, I should say, in 2002. And obviously, the effects are it's killing off our ash trees. So scientists have looked at ways and how we can help maybe take the pest from its native homeland and bring it here to the United States as a natural enemy to help suppress the population.
Mm-hmm. So this stingless wasp is also not native to North America?
Yes, that is correct. It's not native here. It is from the native homeland of EAB, which is over primarily in Asia. So they, shortly after EAB was found here in the United States, scientists went over there, collected some of those and brought them back here, did a lot of studying and research, and came up with basically three different kinds that would work here in the United States to help combat EAB. Here in Iowa, there's really only two that are available. The third one just does not like our cold winters and doesn't survive as well.
Mm-hmm. Tell us more about these two different types of wasps that hopefully are for emerald ash borer killer wasps.
Yeah, the wasp, a lot of people picture wasp as, you know, something with a stinger. They do not have a stinger. They're stingless wasps, first of all. They have an organ on them called an ovipositor that sort of looks like a stinger, and that's used for them to, depending on what type it is, to either lay an egg in the EAB host, either through the bark of the tree, or the other method is the ovipositor can also deposit eggs into the emerald ash borer egg.
Mm-hmm. So this is when the emerald ash borer is in a larvae stage under the bark of the tree, right?
Yeah, correct. The ones that we are releasing now and up in the near future, they do attack the EAB larva stage.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay,
they deposit the eggs in there, and as many as actually 130 or so of these wasps can come out of one EAB larva. So mm-hmm. That's a good thing for us.
Okay, so they inject their eggs into the larvae, and then the larvae, the eggs of this wasp hatch and what, eat the larvae and thereby kill it?
Yeah, they develop inside of it, and as that natural process takes place, it just kind of basically rattles the insides and kills off the larva. It can't survive that.
Mm-hmm. Has this been tried elsewhere in North America?
Yeah, it's it first started in Michigan back in 2007, and obviously many states to the east of us have seen a lot more EAB activity than we have. So the states where it has been more prevalent, this has been used. Of course, this is the first time here in Iowa we're using it, but currently right now we're looking right around 23 states that are utilizing this biocontrol.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how you measure, you called it biocontrol, how do you measure its effectiveness here? Because there's a host of different things we do, like not transporting firewood to slow down the spread of the emerald ash borer, but how do we know how effective these wasps might be here in Iowa?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think time will tell. I can speak for other states. The results that I'm hearing from other states is this is working out pretty well. Generally, there's a kind of a two-year setup period where we're releasing the wasp into the wild, into the woods, and then following that initial setup period, we're going to go out and monitor, take down trees, bark peel, and actually see what the effects are. So we'll have a better idea in probably three or four more years of how effective it is here in Iowa.
So, Mike, the first release of these stingless wasps is happening today. Tell us what will happen or what is happening.
Well, they ship us from the lab in Michigan. They're these little ash, picture them as little ash branches. They're very small. And those have the, the wasps that are developing underneath the bark in those little pieces of branches. And we go out in the wild and hang those in the trees. And, of course, take a lot of recordings of where they're at so we can go back and find them. But we hang them in the trees, and then in approximately about 2 weeks or so, those wasps will start to turn into adults and underneath the bark, and then they will chew their way out, creating little exit holes, and they will fly off in the wild. And the thought is they will go in and have effect on surrounding ash trees and attack other EAP larvae.
Right, and they'll say, oh, they'll discover the emerald ash borer larvae, and they say, oh, yummy, this is a great place to start a family.
And that's what we're hoping.
What about the possibility of unintended consequences? We have this in many areas, technology, but also in nature. When you introduce a non-native species to do one thing, you can't always foresee what might happen. What are your concerns there?
Yeah, the biocontrol programs have really progressed through the decades. There's a lot more thorough process now. There's host specificity testing that goes on to make sure that, beneficials aren't affected in a negative way. They also go through quite a lengthy process with an environmental assessment, so not just insects, but other things as well. So the thing is with these is we're also, people aren't going to normally notice or recognize them in the wild. They're very small, and again, they're not going to sting or harm people or pets.
Right. What about, though, do they only love to use emerald ash borers as hosts, or do they use other beetles that we might not have a problem with?
Their target pest is emerald ash borer. That's their target host. That's who they're going to go after.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are a couple beetles in the Gryllus species that are related to emerald ash borer that they have kind of, maybe touched on a little bit. But generally speaking, they're going to be going out to Emerald Ash Borer.
Okay, Mike Kittner, thank you very much for keeping us up to date on this. I think the program will follow, as you say. We don't know how effective it will be, but we'll follow this and check back with you. Mike Kittner, Emerald Ash Borer and Gypsy Moth Outreach and Regulatory Coordinator with the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, about the first release today of stingless wasps. Yes, these are stingless wasps. Don't worry. They are completely harmless to humans. And Mike, thanks for filling us in.
Thank you very much.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. According to Iowa's Department of Education, nearly one in four public school third graders did not meet state standards for reading proficiency in either the years 2014 or 2015. Add to that the fact that Iowa's minority populations, especially Hispanic and Black students, are falling behind in literacy and kindergarten preparedness. This is what we're calling Iowa's literacy gap. Here to talk about it and what the state is doing to combat this problem, Ryan Wise, Iowa Department of Education Deputy Director. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ben. Thank you for having me.
Ryan, give us a little better outline, if you would, of the problem we're calling the literacy gap here in Iowa.
Sure. So I think you did a nice job of highlighting the challenge we're facing, which is that by the end of third grade, one in four students in Iowa is not reading proficiently. And when you fall behind early in school and don't catch up by the end of third grade, school becomes even more difficult. Reading really is a gateway skill. And so falling behind and not having those critical foundations in literacy makes school more difficult as a student progresses throughout the grades and makes higher level learning and access to more challenging classes and then more challenging opportunities later on in high school and beyond high school more difficult to achieve.
Mm-hmm. This one in four figure, one in four public school third graders not meeting state standards for reading proficiency. Is that a change? Are we getting, did we used to do better there?
You know, for about the last 20 years, that number has been pretty stagnant. So this has been a persistent challenge now for close to a couple of decades.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what are the remedies that the state and communities are looking at and employing?
Right. So as a state, we're taking a comprehensive approach to early literacy, and that means ensuring that all students have access to rigorous, high-quality instruction, and that we have a comprehensive early warning system in place so that students are screened regularly on their reading skills, and we can identify early on where students are struggling and then design supports and interventions to help catch those students up.
Mm-hmm. Do we have the problem in Iowa where students may not be reading up to the level they should be when they're passed on to the next grade, but they are passed on because, you know, parents, kids really hate to stay back a grade, don't they?
Yeah, retention, the question of retention and whether to hold students back is a controversial issue and one that schools struggle with. And certainly schools, you know, are working hard at each grade level, starting in preschool and then in through kindergarten, first, second, third grade, to try and catch students up and really to identify what are the specific challenges and how do we provide the supports they need so that they don't fall behind and so that retention doesn't have to come into play.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about the importance, which you did, of learning early and how that cascades either in a good way or a negative way into learning in future years, you've got to learn it early. So what is the key to making sure a child is literate?
Well, again, to me, a lot of it boils down to identifying what are the specific challenges. So why is a student struggling? And then aligning interventions, resources, support to address those specific learning challenges.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
And that's what we're trying to do with our early warning system, our what we would call screeners, and then ongoing progress monitoring, where if a student early in the year is identified as having challenges, the teacher is then assessing weekly in short kind of snapshots of how is the student progressing, are they making progress at the pace we would want them to ensure they're back on track by the end of the year.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about something that we all have witnessed, that is the generational change. We see youngsters today, just generally speaking, of course, there are a lot of bookworms out there, young bookworms. Mm-hmm. We see youngsters today reading fewer books and spending more time with electronic devices, playing games that don't necessarily involve too much reading. How much of a problem is that?
You know, I don't know. I'm not able to pinpoint that. I do think, you know, we want students to develop a love of reading, right? And so that, you know, when faced with an iPad or a book, sometimes they'll choose the book, and hopefully, you know, more often than not. And so I think it's that not only proficiency in reading, developing the skills, but also cultivating that love and joy for reading as well.
Mm-hmm. According to the National Assessment of Educational Progress, Iowa is falling behind more states in its ability to train teachers to effectively teach reading concepts. So what's to be done about that?
You know, we want to continue to make Iowa a great place to teach and to encourage people to go into teaching. And so I think one of the most exciting things we're doing as a state is we've developed a statewide comprehensive teacher leadership initiative that I think will help people go into teaching. It will encourage them because it creates more opportunities throughout their teaching career to take on compensated leadership roles, and it creates more opportunities for teachers to coach each other and to support each other to address some of these challenges that they're seeing, whether it be in reading or in other areas as well.
Of course, we've got a lot of parents listening to you, Chad Wise. What's the role of parents? Remind us, what are the most important things we can do for youngsters, for those growing up into their teens, to encourage reading and literacy?
You know, reading with your children and reading with other children is critically important. I know a lot of schools, including the school my own sons go to, are working on developing a parent engagement strategy around reading and bringing people in. I just had the pleasure of working with the United Way of Central Iowa. They are launching a major campaign called Read to Succeed that really is encouraging parents to read with their children and to engage the entire community. Literacy development is a team effort, and it's going to take schools, the Department of Education, universities, and communities all working together to address this challenge.
Okay, perhaps you can share with us as we say goodbye. Ryan, have you got a good summer read that you're working on or plan to work on that you share with us?
Oh, you know, I've been reading a book called Aha, about how do moments of inspiration come to us. And so that's
sounds
the
good.
One I'm tackling now. So hopefully I'll have some inspiration that comes to me that I can share with you in the future.
Very good. I'm reading The Fireman. That's by Stephen King's son. It's very, very creepy, of course.
Yeah.
And Boys in the Bunkhouse, a story of what happened here, right here in Iowa, in Atalissa. Thanks very much. Ryan Wise, Iowa Department of Education Deputy Director.
Thanks, Ben.
Internationally best-selling author Bill Bryson visited his home state of Iowa last week to speak at the University of Iowa commencement ceremony. And in his speech, he talked about what it means to be an Iowan. He offered a few tips. He calls the list his 10 simple rules for happiness.
1. Take a moment from time to time to remember that you are alive. Now, I know that sounds a trifle obvious, but it's astounding, really, how little time we take to remark upon this singular and gratifying fact. By the most extraordinary stroke of luck, an infinitesimal amount of the universe came, matter in the universe came together 20 or so years ago to make you. And for the tiniest moment in the great span of creation, you have the incomparable privilege to exist. For endless eons, there was no you. Before too terribly long, you will cease to be again. And in between, you have this wonderful opportunity to see and feel and think and do. Whatever else you do with your life, nothing will remotely compare with the incredible accomplishment of just having managed to get yourself born. So congratulations to every one of you out there tonight. Well done. Be proud of yourself. You really are quite special. 2, but not that special. There are 7 billion other people on this planet, every one of them just as important, just as central to the great scheme of things as you are. Don't ever make the embarrassing, unworthy mistake of thinking yourself more vital or significant, more innately worthy than anyone else. You're not. 3, whatever it is you want to do in life, do it. If you aspire to be an astronaut or a celebrated ballerina or to sing at Carnegie Hall, go for it. Even though everyone is tactfully pointing out to you that you cannot sing a note or that no one has ever won the 100-meter dash with a personal best time of 1 minute and 48 seconds, do it anyway if that's your dream. At least try. There is nothing worse than getting to my age and saying, I could have played shortstop for the Chicago Cubs, but my dad wanted me to go into accountancy. Tell your dad to go into accountancy. You climb Everest. 4. Never, never sneak up on people from behind and surprise them in the belief that it is amusing. It's not. 5, be modest. Don't go through life boasting about how great you are. Boasting doesn't become you. Indeed, it doesn't get you anywhere. No one will ever thank you or admire you more deeply or say, oh, let's invite Bob and Amy to the party. They have such a wonderfully inflated sense of their own importance. Let people find out for themselves how great you are, if you are. 6, learn to appreciate small pleasures. If you think about it, most of every life is a long, steady, pleasing accumulation of little things. Of lovely skies, interesting landscapes, pleasant meals, amusing conversation, stimulating challenges, long walks, good books, contented weekends, hot baths and clean sheets, little jokes, soft young children, slobbery pets, and a million things more. Life is mostly good stuff. Most of it small and fleeting, much of it barely noticed, but nearly all of it really quite splendid. Learn to appreciate those little things if you haven't already. 7, be good. In fact, be more than good. Be compassionate, be kind, and particularly be kind to people who are worse off than you, which you will find is most people. And learn to say please and thank you a lot. You really cannot say thank you too much in this life. 8, always buy my books in hardback as soon as they come out. 9, above all else, be happy, really happy, more or less all the time. You have a million things to be happy about. You're bright and young, and you have your whole lives in front of you. You have been impeccably educated. You live in a rich country. You're probably about as fit and healthy as you're ever going to be. And you still have more hair on your head than in your nose and in your ears. And And that may not last forever, believe me. So count your blessings and be glad of them. And finally, 10, and this one is just for Iowa City. If you are planning to do heavy construction work involving jackhammers just outside the Hotel Vetro on South Lynn Street, perhaps you might think about starting just a little later than 6:15 in the morning.
All right, 10 simple rules for happiness, courtesy of international best-selling author Bill Bryson. He spoke last week at the University of Iowa commencement for undergraduates. And that wraps up our program for today. River to River, produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, with help from Lauren Knutson. And our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Let's go out with a little bit of college music. This is a tune called College Green from a Quad Cities band, a ska punk band named Fairhaven. They're going to be on Java Blend Saturday at 1, my music show Saturday at 1. Here's a little taste of them. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.
This one's the worst, so I think I'm staying home. And the window's open. Can't get away from you.